Hello, and welcome to another episode of Endeavors. On today's show, I chat with filmmakers Leroy Kuntz and Crew Ennis, and singer, songwriter, author, multimedia artist Leanne Simpson. That's coming up on Endeavors.
I pity the country, I pity the state. In the mind of a man who thrives on hate. Small are the lies of cheats and of liars, of bigoted news press, fascist town criers.
Well, hello, and welcome to another episode of Endeavors. I know, I've got two up within a span of the week. Does this mean I'm back? Maybe, maybe not. That opening music you heard there was from the Indigenous artist Willie Dunn with I Pity the Country. It is the National Day of Truth and Reconciliation tomorrow, and part of the show we'll cover that with one of my guests, the immensely talented singer-songwriter, author, multimedia artist, filmmaker, Leanne Simpson. And more on her in a little bit. It does feel slightly weird to be sitting here recording this on my birthday. I'm 35 today. I've heard some people use 35 as a metric for middle age. I've always understood it to be 40, so I guess I have a few years to go. At any rate, it's an interesting time for reflection, especially since this is my second consecutive birthday not in Canada. Last year, I was fortunate enough to spend it in Vienna. I remember I was in my hostel. I didn't really tell anybody, and we had spent that afternoon, you know, the sort of early, late morning, early afternoon in a mojito making workshop in the bar of our hostel, St. Christopher's in Vienna. So that was a lot of fun. This year, obviously, it's different. You know, I'm working again full time, was working this morning, did solo breakfast, you know, and I'm in a much more open spot where I already know a few people. So it's nice to be here, but I think, you know, turning 35 definitely kind of, you know, makes you think a little bit about things, the future, success, whatever that means, that sort of thing. But yeah, I just wanted to throw that out there about myself. Not that anybody was necessarily paying attention to that or, you know, was interested in that. But, you know, here we are. Might have a little shindig tonight at the bar here at the hotel. There's also a cocktail party hosted by one of my coworkers who's leaving soon. So it'll kind of be a little bit of a dovetail. But I think it'll be good times. You know, I'm relaxed. I'm a lot more calmer, I think, than I have been in the past, which I think is just a product of being here on the island and, you know, kind of, you know, still having access to, you know, internet and your devices and stuff, but, you know, kind of just being in and amongst the water and the sheep and the trees and all that jazz. I just want to make a note before we start. You probably remember, you know, a while ago, this show was doing a lot of longer form interviews. You know, some were up for an hour and some were up for an hour and a half. And I'm trying to get back to that. Right now, the interviews will be a little bit shorter, My paid version of Zoom has expired, and I have to check with the dues, but I'm not really in a position where I can afford to pay the, whatever it is for the Zoom premium. Initially you could get just two people back and forth for as long as you wanted, but if it was three or more, it was 40. But I think they changed that, or I just need to mess with my settings. Anyway, I might start a Patreon. I know I've been saying that for like, I don't know how long, but since I'm now kind of coming live from the middle of nowhere, I might actually, start considering it. More, I should say, than I was in the past. So anyway, prepare for, episodes, shows to be shorter than you're used to, probably, 45, 50 minutes, something like that, 55. I guess it really depends on how long I ramble at the beginning of each episode, and if I put one interview on its own or two together, or a lot of different options that I can do. But all of this is to say that for the time being, they'll probably be a little bit shorter than you're used to. I mean, no one wants to hear my voice drone on and drone on. Anyway, but we do have a couple of great guests today. I did mention at the start of the show, Leanne Simpson, the multi-talented, multifaceted, multimedia Indigenous artist, and she will be coming on a little bit later on. But I wanted to start the show today with more horror, because that's just my thing. The other week, I got to speak with two delightful gentlemen who are the team behind the new horror film Deliver Us. Which follows a nun in a remote convent who claims immaculate conception, and the Vatican sends a team of priests to investigate, concerned about the ancient prophecy that a woman will give birth to twin boys, one the Messiah and one the Antichrist. Religious horror is exploding right now, although it's always been around. I mean, The Exorcist is still one of the greatest horror films ever made. But specifically, I think in religious horror these days, we're seeing a lot of films with nuns as the central character, or films being sent being set at a convent or a nunnery. And this is, another great twist on that. And it's also a great allusion to some of the prophecies, or perhaps some theories that people have in the Bible, whether or not, whether you choose to believe in that or not. The Leroy Kuntz is the writer director, and Crewe Ennis is the co-director and producer on the film. And the film, I should say, by the way, boasts a great cast. Alexander Siddig, Thomas Kretschmann, Lena Barbalus, all great performers, and such an international cast as well. And I got to talk about all these aspects with these two great filmmakers. So, without further ado, here is my chat with Leroy Kuntz and Crewe Ennis.
Hi, Dan.
Hey boys, how are you?
Well,
Doing
doing very
great.
well.
Crew Ennis and Leroy Kuntz, you have a new horror film out. Deliver Us. First of all, what was it like directing as a duo? Because that has that's its own unique thing, or it can be.
I would say it was it's kind of a lot of people think it'd be stressful because you have competing visions, but when you have someone you trust, you can lean on them. Because like directing a film, especially a low budget film, is like an overwhelming experience for a long amount of time. And then having someone you believe in and someone you trust to share that burden is a great, great gift. So me and Leroy, cut me off whenever you want, but we would we spend a lot of time together in life, so we talk every day. It was just us locked in a room, and then most of the time our cinematographer was there and kind of developing the vision for this film and what it was going to be with the restraints that we had. And then when it came time to enact, it was kind of like playing a sport where it's like running routes or singing a song that you've done 100 times. It's just like it's time to execute. And that's kind of my take. So I mean, it was a beautiful learning experience, and we have a very brotherly relationship. So in a room, we might be yelling at each other, but when we face the world and our crew, we come out as like a unity. Not too long ago, I was with one of our actors, Thomas Kretschmann, and he was explaining our duo, and he said it was beautiful to watch. Because it was two people that cared about each other and they killed their ego. So that's kind of how we went into it, just respect for one another. But sorry to monopolize the question, Leroy.
Well, I think it's just about being able to divide and conquer, so much. And so two things need to get done at one time. Usually it's three or four things on a film set, and we could each do that. And then I think it makes the decision-making process happen quicker. Like usually to make a good choice on something, you might need to rest on it or sleep on it. You need to get like a different headspace, but then you can immediately bounce it off someone, and then you can come in together and like, okay, we got it. Yeah.
It's we see a lot of films, especially now in sort of the horror renaissance, if you will, that fall under religious horror or have religious themes. Why is it in particular that this subgenre can be so effective as a storytelling medium?
I think it's probably because it's our most primal like stories in all of us in every culture. We're definitely influenced by the Joseph Campbell thing where he like tries to find those unifying myths. It just is like it's in all of us. And I think that people do have a like some sort of religious like sense or meaning that's drawing towards them. And then just the kind of pressure everyone's been under in the last probably 3 years has probably heightened it and brought out those feelings even stronger.
Good answer.
What do, I mean, overall, what do you like about sort of the horror film in general? Because crew, I know you've worked a lot on sort of like kind of socially conscious films, and there's a debate about how much horror can tell us about ourselves. But what do you like overall about the medium of horror as an art form?
Leroy has a great answer to that question from his college professor, but for me, I like the idea of examining biblical themes in a real way with and like taking the repercussions of these incidents that really grabs at people and makes them think about their state and like in the world and the relationship with a higher power. And that's kind of my thoughts on it. But Leroy, what was it that you learned from your professor? It was so interesting.
Oh, yeah, so my favorite professor at USC, he was an ex-Jesuit priest, and he had us watch all these different horror films. He said it was the only genre where you could make a film about God or divinity, from audiences would accept it and engage with it. So that got me interested in it. And then also when horror's done right, I think it's kind of like a Brothers Grimm or a fairy tale you tell kids about, like the really horrific ones, to kind of warn them about dangers in the world. So you get to like sit down and experience the worst humanity has to offer, or like evil, and then like almost simulate like what, you know, how you would confront that or deal with it in a way.
You have such an international cast in this. You know, Thomas is German, Alexander's British, Marie, I think, is Finnish. Was that intentional? And what does that kind of internationalism add to a story like this?
I think authenticity. We really liked what they did with the witch and casting really great character actors, and then people that were widely unknown in most parts of the world, especially America. I mean, Thomas and Sid are, but they're, you know, they're such great chameleons, and then putting them in that environment, you kind of forget the history of all the great things they did. But I think it just helps you reach more people and gives you a sense of authenticity for that region of the world.
Horror, you know, horror films can be so much fun to shoot. I've had the privilege on working on a few myself. Was there a favorite moment that for either of you that happened during filming that just really stuck with you for whatever reason?
The wolves, right? I mean, they're just, it's so deep in our, like, humans to be afraid of wolves in this story, and then to like spend 2 days with them and be right up in them and seeing them growl. You basically threatening to kill you if you get coming. There's just something like, wow.
They're very majestic. They're very intimidating. I mean, majestic covers it, but beautiful. Seeing them work, and then like Leroy being able to interact with them, you know, playing Father Fox and capturing that was awesome. That, and then, yeah, that was great.
Given the sort of the overall, you know, sort of stylization of this film, what kind of conversations do you have with your editor or your cinematographer, and how early on do those conversations happen about, you know, just the right tone you need to set? Because horror can be such a tonally challenging genre at times.
Well, for us, we have really detailed pitch decks that kind of build out the whole film style and tone, and it gives all of the key creatives something to build off of and add to. It's kind of what me and Leroy really put a lot of time and energy in the last year, because the idea is to really extrapolate every bits of talent and creativity out of these other artists. And it's like, this is what we like, this is what we want to do. And we did that mostly with our deck, and then after that, it was just like taking those lessons and then implementing them down the line with, you know, your editor, your composer, your sound designer, who are all, you know, geniuses in their own right, at least the ones we have on our film.
Yeah.
You know, given the sort of the themes that are addressed in the film, is there one message or perhaps one idea that you would want a prospective audience to either take away or maybe at least wrestle with?
Yeah, I think the biggest theme we explore is the problem of evil. And so when you are confronted with it in the world, it is not to like look and say that the whole world is horrible, and it's like, you know, it's like kind of like that the world is worth the saving, or there's like hope in that kind of despair, or that you can see yourself through it. It's like, yeah, all these horrible things exist, but, you know.
Good answer.
Well, the film is Deliver Us, and it is on theaters on demand and digital on September 29th, 2023. That's 1 week from when we are recording. Crew Ennis, Neroy Kuntz, thank you so much for your time this afternoon. Thank you.
Thank you, Dan. It was awesome. Thank you.
Meaning.
Cheers.
Thank you.
That was my interview with filmmakers Leroy Kuntz and Crew Ennis. They are the directing team behind the new horror film Deliver Us, which is officially out today, September 29th. A great way to launch into Halloween month. We are going to shift gears now here a little bit, as I want to do on this program. I mentioned off the top of the show that tomorrow, September 30th, in Canada, is National Truth and Reconciliation Day. And for those that don't know, Truth and Reconciliation is, or at least it started as this commission to document the history and lasting impacts of the Canadian Indian residential school system, which is where Indigenous kids were forced to be taken from their homes and put into schools run largely by Catholics and Protestants, and basically were tried to basically were forced to assimilate as the government tried to scrub the Indigenous heritage out of them to kind of put it in a way. And so now it's become, some might call it a movement. But it's become a conversation. It's become a dialogue. Canada has formally apologized for its roles in the residential school system and the 60s scoop, which was the sort of this big piece that blew the lid off of this thing that was happening in our country. And in June 2015, the commission released its findings along with 94 calls to actions and concluded that the school system amounted to cultural genocide. And so now the government is trying to, and there's still a long way to go. But it's been a goal of Canada the last number of years to try and, atone for our history and, do better moving forward in, whether it's teaching about Indigenous history in schools or, providing water and emergency services to rural reserves, or having the indigenous population have greater autonomy and self-government over their nations, all sorts of things, and now we're finding a lot of unmarked graves of kids at residential schools, which is another big thing that sort of Canada is reckoning with and reconciling with, if you will. And if I am not doing a great job of sort of articulating what this day is and the importance of the day, but hopefully my next guest can, and she is Leanne Simpson. She is a multimedia artist. She's an author. She's a singer-songwriter. And she has sort of released this new short film music video called, and it's a cover. It's her cover of a song called I Pity the Country. And I Pity the Country was a song originally done by an artist named Willie Dunn, who was Mi'kmaq, which is a nation sort of more out east in Canada. And he's considered one of the greatest and one of the most important Indigenous artists of our country. And Leanne Simpson, you know, who is also Indigenous, has covered the song, and actually in 2021 was the winner of the Prism Prize's Willie Dunn Award. She is a member of the Alderville First Nation, and for this project, she teamed up with Anishinaabe filmmaker Lisa Jackson and Indigenous Métis filmmaker Connor McNally to release the short film I Pity the Country, the found footage music video. And so, you know, Leanne talks about how this project got started, why she chose this song, what Willie Dunn means to her and Indigenous Canadians, what the National Day of Truth and Reconciliation means to her, and just sort of, you know, being an Indigenous artist in Canada and Canada-Indigenous relations and all of that. It's heavy, but it's also joyous at the same time. So this is my chat with Leanne Simpson. Leanne Simpson, hello. How are we doing today?
I'm good, thank you.
So you are part of I Pity the Country, which is obviously airing in time for National Day for Truth and Reconciliation on the 30th. But how did you become involved in this project?
So I do a number of things. I wear a number of hats in my life. I'm a writer, I'm an academic, and I'm a musician. And so in 2018, my band and I were invited to be a part of the Native North American gathering at the National Center for the Arts in Ottawa, Ontario, Canada. And this was a concert that was celebrating the release of the Native North American album, which was celebrating sort of that generation of Indigenous musicians that came before my generation. So it was celebrating the old timers. A lot of them were still alive and playing music, but it was really clear to me that they were working in a time where there were a lot of barriers for Indigenous musicians. And so it was just this sort of really beautiful celebration in a beautiful venue. And I wanted to include something from Willie Dunn, because Willie Dunn was an important activist, an important filmmaker, and a really amazing musician that was part of the Native North American Gathering album, but he had passed on. So I knew his family was going to be in the audience. He had lived in Ottawa for a number of years. And so I was looking for one of his songs to cover, and I came across I Pity. And it just resonated, I think, with everything that was going on. It resonated in my bones. The lyrics stood the test of time. And so my band sort of reimagined the song right before we were to take the stage at the National Arts Center. The news of the man who had murdered Colton Bushy, who was a Cree young person that was murdered in Saskatchewan had been acquitted. And so that news was announced to the audience right before we took the stage. And in that moment of grief, and I think disbelief, and what many people felt was a tremendous miscarry of justice, this song took on new meaning. And it was this moment of in a live performance that I think I'll never forget. And I think the audience, people that I have talked to that were in the audience, will never forget. So we wanted to record it after we had that experience with the song and the power of the song. And so we eventually recorded our version that you hear in the film, and it was released on my album Theory of Ice through You've Changed Records. So part of that project, I was looking to help the music travel. From my past record In Flight, I had worked with a number of emerging Indigenous filmmakers to make kind of short films, a little different take on the music video idea. And I wanted to do the same for I Pity. So Elisa Jackson was the filmmaker that I really, really wanted to work with on this project. The idea of an archival film came from those early discussions. And it's taken a while to get the film finished, but it's now ready to be released into the world.
What did Willie Dunn mean to the Indigenous arts community in Canada, do you think?
I mean, he was in some ways that hardworking kind of Indigenous folk singer who was traveling the country with his guitar, singing the songs of the time. He did a lot of work very particularly to make sure that he was connecting to Indigenous people. So you can see that opening part of the film where he's in a Métis Friendship Center playing to young people. That was definitely part of his practice. He didn't shy away from the politics of the time. He was also involved in the Red Power movement and in organizing. He was someone who was both local and sort of international in his activism. And so he, I think that that's reflected in his songs as well. He was also worked as part of the Native film crew at the National Film Board of Canada, which was the first sort of Indigenous unit in the National Film Board. And you can see from the film that we relied on that archive of film that was so important in terms of documenting Indigenous resistance through the last, 3 decades, in addition to some of the CBC archives. So I think that that's also part of Willie Dunn's legacy.
You know, we're finally starting to see a lot more Indigenous stories being told by Indigenous creators in Canada, but we still haven't seen, you know, as many documentary or quote unquote archival projects as you know, maybe narrative projects. How do you think your archival project complements or contrasts to perhaps what the CBC has, or what, you know, maybe what some non-Indigenous filmmakers have done with this material?
I think that in 5.5 minutes, this film shows a tremendous breadth of Indigenous resistance and Indigenous organizing against colonialism, stretching back to the 1960s, which in a lot of ways has been very invisibilized to Canadians and to the rest of the world. And so this shows, I think, in a really short period of time, across the country, all different kinds of cultures and communities engaged in fighting for the land, defending the land, engaged in making the lives of their people and their families better. And it also shows this tremendous Indigenous joy and Indigenous life. So there's lots of shots from these films of like kids running and doing silly things and the beautiful parts of Indigenous life as well. And so I think that those two aspects are not often in the mainstream mainstream media. It's often very focused on current manifestations of colonialism and violence and problems. So I think it's meaningful to me to have this released on September 30th, because it shows this part of our communities and this part of our history that isn't present in those Truth and Reconciliation commemorative sort of events.
You know, this is a sort of a multimedia, multifaceted project. How does music, how does film, how does the arts in general, how much a part of Indigenous society and Indigenous storytelling are they? Like, how big of a part do they play?
They're everything. Making things is an incredible important part of the fabric of Indigenous life. So when I think back to my ancestors, even going back two or three generations, they were getting up in the morning, they were making their food, their transportation, their clothes, their political system, their spirituality. They were engaged in creative sovereignty and creative practices as a way of making life. Storytelling was an incredibly important part of life and a practice that deepened relationships and bonds with people. And I think that the Indigenous arts community that we've seen in Canada really flourish in the last decade or so is really inherited that. Those practices that have kept our people close together, that have kept our stories alive, that have brought us so much joy, and that have also been a form of resistance.
And now you mentioned your collaborators on this. You've got Lisa Jackson and you've got Connor McNally. And I know Lisa is the founder of Door Number 3 Productions. How important is it in this era of sort of representation and, you know, trying to tell authentic stories that we have here? We have a media production company that is actually Indigenous founded, Indigenous led, female founded, female led.
Well, it's amazing. And it's amazing because I could take this idea to Lisa and have her it resonates with her immediately and she gets it immediately. And so the curation of the archival material was done in a very thorough and a very meticulous way. The artistic choices that they made and the political choices that they made were done without us having to have a lot of discussion about it. I think she was very attentive to gender in the short film as well. And so those are it's a joy to work actually with her and to work in a situation where you're not always constantly having to go back to square one and explain why things are important. So it was a very easy collaboration, and it was, I feel like Lisa really pushes towards excellence, and I really appreciate that as well. I think that we're both Anishinaabe. I think that's a really important Anishinaabe practice in the arts and in creative practices.
Now you mentioned that you were both Anishinaabe. Now when you're making something like this, what is the line between sort of, okay, are we telling an Indigenous story or are we telling specifically an Anishinaabe story?
Well, we certainly were not telling a specific Anishinaabe story. The Willie Dunn was Mi'kmaq. And if you look at the film, we've got footage from Dene communities, from Haida Gwaii, from the prairies, from Haudenosaunee communities. So we wanted to have a diversity of different Indigenous cultures and Indigenous geographies and regions represented in the film. But I think there's a common experience of colonialism and what it means to be Indigenous in Canada. There is common points of organization in terms of pushing back politically amongst us. And so I think that it was never envisioned as being just an Anishinaabe project. It was very much envisioned as being something that expanded across Canada because of that archive with the NFB.
You know, we are seeing a lot more, I mean, in a way, we're seeing a lot more coverage of Indigenous stories, but it feels like we're still talking either about uncovered graves or missing persons or an Indigenous film, you know, or something happening on a reserve or in a small town. What do you think that the mainstream and the colonial media still don't maybe understand about covering Indigenous stories or what it means to be Indigenous, and how does that change?
I think that there's a lot of narratives around trauma and around sort of parading out those individual traumas for the consumption of Canadians. And I think that that's always been difficult for me to watch, because I think so much of the history of colonialism and capitalism in Canada has been about a very violent past and has been about removing and dispossessing Indigenous peoples from our lands, from our bodies, from our artistic practices, from our thought, and from each other. And so I think one of the things that I like about the way that I Pity the Country, the short film, has come together is that each of these clips is from a full film that is about a specific issue in Canadian state, Indigenous state relations. And it's in a long form documentary. So in a sense, this film is like a gateway to like a whole bunch of other films and a whole bunch of other history that's online at the NFB archive, that's online at the CBC archives, that people can access to learn the context for the issues that you're seeing in the media today, the historical context. And I think that that's really important because colonialism and the heteropatriarchy, the capitalism, the gender violence, everything that is sort of leading to this present moment is still ongoing in Canada, and it's still rooted in that history.
We should point out, you know, this film in a way is an ode to Willie Dunn, but I know that in 2021, you won the Prism Prize's Willie Dunn Award. How does that feel? You know, here you are, you know, you've been a lifelong fan of Willie Dunn, you're sort of covering his work, and then to be given his namesake prize, does that add something extra to this project in a way?
That added something extra because it's difficult to be a musician in Canada right now. It's difficult to be an Indigenous musician. The pandemic has been devastating. It's economically really hard to be sort of like a mid-level band. It's hard to make music right now. So I think that I've always wanted to take this idea of the music video and really expand what it meant. So I've made a lot of videos where my kids look at them, they're like, "Mom, have you ever even seen a music video? Because what you are making is not what we are watching, FYI. And so it was really lovely to have that sort of recognition that I was sort of using this videos and film in a different way. With my music, I was using it to add another layer of meaning. I was using it for the music to travel, for the ideas to travel, for people to connect in a different way. And so it was lovely. It was lovely to be recognized with that award. It was really meaningful.
You know, there's always a debate about, you know, how much politics should go into art and whatever we do. But for you, how much crossover do you find? Is art always political, or can we separate it?
I think for me, being an Anishinaabe woman in Canada, that's always political. Every time I step up to a mic in front of an audience, that's a political act. There are certain expectations. There are just the idea. Indigenous women in our power and our knowledge and our experience have been so removed and erased, and in some cases eliminated in Canada, that part is a political act. I think that in my work, I want my artistic work, I want my music to, and my writing, I want it to reflect me and my understandings and my reality. And I want Anishinaabe people first to be able to see themselves inside their work, inside my work, and to feel that affirmation and that that kind of mutual recognition. And so that's the line. So when I'm thinking about politics, it's sort of where it lands in my heart and where it lands authentically in that moment when I'm making something. And so sometimes it comes out, and I think people experience it as a more overt political song or piece of writing. And other times, you know, sometimes the most political things to me myself don't resonate that way with audiences.
You know, with so much discussion about identity these days, people always talk about labels. You know, this person is, you know, trans, or you know, this person is X. For you, is that label always going to be a factor? Like, do you always want to be the Indigenous Canadian, you know, the Indigenous Canadian artist and performer, or the Anishinaabe performer, or eventually do you just want to be a performer?
I'm always going to be very, very proud of being Anishinaabe. And that's always going to be the core of who I am. And I would like to be known as a writer and a thinker and an academic and a performer and a musician in my own right. Yep.
You know, for the sort of colonial audience, let's put it that way, that will maybe see this short film, what sort of message or perhaps nugget of ideas would you like them to take away or go home with or let percolate in their minds?
I think the first thing that's gonna happen is that people are gonna realize that there is a whole bunch of history around organizing and resistance that they're not aware of, because there's 5 minutes of documentary clips and archival material that, unless you've been paying very close attention to what's been happening in the Indigenous world, it wouldn't be recognizable. So I think that that's one thing that's going to happen. I think a second thing that's going to happen is you're going to see those kids running. You're going to see laughter. You're going to see this diversity of Indigenous life in the films that is different than what you've maybe seen in the mainstream media or on social media. And I think that that's really important as well.
What was your favorite moment, let's call it, from working on this project?
I think the first time that I saw the rough cut was my favorite moment, because it is that moment of relief where you're like they really got what I was talking about. This is going to the moment where you're like, oh, this is going to be good. Now, this wasn't a crazy idea. it was a moment of relief, and that I remember just watching it on my computer. I didn't have everything all set up. I was just sort of excited to watch it. And I was like, oh, this is going to be really, really good. This is aligned with what I thought this was going to be. This is aligned to that moment where I stepped out on that stage up to the mic and performed this song for the first time.
Well, the project, music video, short film, multimedia art is called I Pity the Country, and the found footage music video drops September 29th, 2023, in time for, and I want to get this title right, National Day for Truth and Reconciliation, which is on September 30th. Just before we go, just a note on that day, on Saturday the 30th. What does that day mean to you?
That day, I think, it's a difficult day for a lot of Indigenous people. And so one of the things that I like to do is to check in with friends and family, to sort of be out on the land with community, to be doing kind of those care things. Recognizing that for residential school survivors and for their families, having this suddenly be in the news and in wide, you know, discussed is a good thing, but it's also a painful thing. And so it's a day of caretaking, I think, for me.
Well, as we mentioned, the music video drops tomorrow on September 29th, and it's Lee Ann Simpson performing Willie Dunn. Lee Ann Simpson, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you so much.
All right, cheers.
Bye now. Bye.
That was my conversation with artist Lee Ann Dunn. She is behind I Pity the Country, the found footage music video, which comes out today, September 29th. It will be at 10 a.m. Eastern time in Canada, so it should be out now. And it'll be available for free on the YouTube channel Door Number 3 Productions. That is youtube.com/@door3 with a capital D, capital N, and the number 3, not spelled out, just the number. So that's youtube.com/@door3. It's a really good music video. I had a chance to watch it. I hope everyone listening has a chance to check it out. And as like Lee Ann says, you know, check in with people and, you know, think about how you can better the world. Even if you don't know any Indigenous people, you know, just think about how you can, you know, how you can create a better world, not only for yourself, but for them and for everybody else. That does it for me today. My thanks to Lee Ann Simpson. My thanks to Crew Ennis and Leroy Kuntz. Thanks for tuning in, and I'll see you next time. Bye for now.